Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. In the Yemeni situation and the security of the Red Sea and the Bab el-Mandeb Strait, there is a direct impact on the American strategic security concept over an extended period of decades. Converging at the intersection of navigation security, energy security, and the security of the Zionist-occupying entity symbolized by the Red Sea. Now, every day, the Yemeni armed forces challenge this strategic concept of American security, leaving the United States with limited options. Either exert pressure to stop the Israeli aggression, the Israeli entity aggression on Gaza, or engage in a broader war that would disrupt navigation, impede energy flow, and turn the Red Sea into a war zone. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Ali Murad, political commentator and also journalist at Al Akhbar newspaper, Lebanese daily newspaper. Thanks a million for being with us, Mr. Awi. Now, there is a clear development in the history of the resistance after October 7th. Al-Aqsa flood operation after the introduction of the equation of the Red Sea and the Bab el-Mandeb Strait. How significant, in your view, is this new role by the Yemeni armed forces?
Undoubtedly, the Yemeni contribution within the support fronts for the Palestinian people in the Gaza Strip, aiming to stop the aggression against the Palestinians, gains international significance. This distinguishes the Yemeni front from other fronts in southern Lebanon and Iraq. So far, the real impacts of Yemeni support on the global America's strategy, specifically in the Indo-Pacific region, have not been fully assessed. The Zionist role aligns with this American strategy to enhance trade with Southeast Asian countries, part of an attempt to encircle and undermine China. Today, Yemen's geographical location, coupled with the escalating strength due to the ongoing aggression for 9 years, has given them the ability, power and determination in targeting the U.S. strategy before discussing any economic harm to the Israeli entity economy. Hence, we understand why Washington is very disturbed by this Yemeni contribution and why the U.S. attempts to garner international support, viewing it as an effort to undermine the Yemeni resistance and its contributions to supporting resistance in Gaza.
Well, Mr. Ali, the two giant shipping companies, the Danish Maersk and the German Hapag-Lloyd, have announced the suspension of their voyages in the Red Sea, with operations being put on hold until further notice. This is what the statements of the two companies said. This marks a significant development in the Red Sea, obviously, and in the Red Sea standoff in general, and its impact on international navigations, since these two companies represent about 21.8% of the global trade. That's huge numbers, billions of dollars here. Is that an enough pressure message to the United States and the West to oblige them to take action against the Yemeni armed resistance in the Red Sea? We did hear the Pentagon saying certain stuff and saying that the U.S. defense minister has a trip this week to West Asia. What do you think about that?
I believe the situation is the opposite. The United States has been trying for weeks to engage major world powers in order to secure an international decision, preferably from the UN Security Council, to form a global force to confront Yemenis in the Bab el-Mandeb area. However, there hasn't been international enthusiasm. Reports leaked from China indicate that U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken tried unsuccessfully to persuade China towards this direction. I think the Americans pressured maritime companies to issue such statements, aiming to impose a de facto situation on the international community, causing a paralysis in trade through the Red Sea. This is an attempt to enforce a new reality. The U.S. is trying to impose a new reality alongside the announcement of the alliance it desires, forming a military force in the Arabian Sea and the Red Sea. However, strategically looking at the position of military vessels and aircraft carriers, this alliance has been in place for years, ostensibly to prevent arms smuggling to Yemen, whether in the Gulf of Aden, the Red Sea, or the Gulf of Oman. Therefore, this U.S. move seems to be merely symbolic to justify their upcoming actions in that region.
Well, we did hear the U.S. envoy to Yemen, Mr. Tim Lenderking. I have so much to say about that man, but I will refrain. He told Reuters that the United States wants to form the widest possible maritime alliance to allegedly to protect ships in the Red Sea and send a, I quote, significant signal to the Ansarullah that there will be no tolerance for further attacks. How do you think Yemen will react to these threats?
I believe one of the unannounced U.S. objectives for forming this alliance is to serve the previously declared strategy of building new alliances and reviving old ones. In this case, we have an existing alliance that has been in place for years. Any military move by the U.S. and its allies toward the Yemeni mainland is likely to trigger natural reactions from Sana'a. Just envision a scenario where there is indeed a confrontation, such as a Western American attack on locations in Sana'a or the Yemeni coast. Without a doubt, there will be reactionary responses involving anti-ship missiles, drones, and possibly even naval mines, potentially causing a global disruption in maritime navigation. This, of course, will put pressure on the global economy. Beyond the maritime and navigation aspect, there's the issue of oil facilities. Yemen is officially still in a state of war with the coalition of aggression attacking it, and the ceasefire is ongoing without formal renewal. This presents an opportunity for Sana'a to target energy sources and oil reservoirs, causing hardships for Americans. If the situation escalates into a near-war scenario in the southern Arabian Peninsula, it would lead to a spike in oil prices coinciding with upcoming U.S. elections, causing devastating effects on the U.S. and Western economies.
Well, it's in less than a minute, but wouldn't that be an opportunity for Mohammed bin Salman to re-engage in war against Yemen?
Mohammed bin Salman is aware of the significant repercussions on Saudi Arabia's economy and his Vision 2030 plan. Hence, we've been witnessing leaked media reports for weeks, suggesting that Saudi Arabia is sending messages to Sana'a, indicating a lack of interest in escalating tensions with Yemen. The U.S. has been trying to get Saudi Arabia involved in this so-called international coalition to deter the Yemeni involvement in the fight against Zionist Israeli aggression and genocide in Gaza. Yet, so far we have not seen real enthusiasm from the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia towards any escalation with Yemen. I believe that the Yemenis are fully aware what it means for Mohammed bin Salman to allow another round of violence against Yemen. For instance, it means that the Saudi oil refineries would again come under fire with Yemeni missiles. And it also means that the Saudi much-anticipated Vision 2030 will not see the light of day in the upcoming 7 years. MBS also knows this very well. He is adamant on making Vision 2030 a done deal, that he is willing to not join any new coalition of aggression against the Yemeni armed forces. MBS was aiming to build a fresh start with Yemen. Any sudden unwelcome moves would spark another wave of violence, a violence that would for sure light up the entire Arabian Peninsula, meaning that not only KSA will suffer the consequences, rather the shockwave of consequences will affect all the Arabian Peninsula regimes. Consequently, there is a push to expedite reaching a political agreement between the two countries in negotiations that have been stalled for 2 years.
Well, that definitely sounds interesting. I want to thank you very much, Mr. Ali Murad, political commentator and journalist at Al Akhbar, for joining us to tell us the latest of what might happen considering the Yemeni armed forces attempt to perform a maritime blockade against the Zionist entity in support of Palestine. Thanks a million for your time and your contribution. Ladies and gents, please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about how the confrontations between the resistance axis and the Zionist and American entity are escalating.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
It is certain that all the fronts in the confrontation with the Zionist entity have moved simultaneously. What is definite is that these fronts have significantly contributed to solidifying the Palestinian cause as a central issue within the project of the resistance axis. They did not wait for a signal from anyone to start targeting the institutions of the Zionist entity from southern Lebanon to the Red Sea, including Eilat, passing through Iraq and Syria with a particular focus on Palestine. More details in the following report.
The recent Israeli entity aggression on Gaza and its subsequent expansion of military operations beyond the borders of Gaza, reaching the southern border of Lebanon, Iraq, Syria, and Yemen in the Red Sea, has created an atmosphere of regional tension. At this stage, the axis of resistance, primarily composed of cohesive native armed factions, has emerged as a key player. These factions promote themselves as advocates of resistance as a strategic choice against Zionist Israel and the United States of America, positioning it as the sole tool for the liberation of Palestinian territories, with Al-Quds at the forefront, while backing the resistance in Gaza. For the first time since the consolidation of the axis of resistance and the alliances within it, we see it engaged in such a significant and wide-ranging battle within the framework of the Al-Aqsa flood battle. It is no secret that the Islamic Republic of Iran has a relationship of support, endorsement, and coordination with the countries of the axis of resistance through relations with Arab countries such as Palestine, Iraq, Syria, Yemen, and Lebanon. The discussion about the axis of resistance and the struggle of the axis of resistance against the Israeli entity is not new. However, what is contemporary today is that the Axis is leading its first significant battle against the Israeli entity and behind it, the United States of America. Various strikes have been carried out against U.S. occupation bases and the Zionist entity in the region, but the battle tactics employed by the operations room of the Axis of Resistance have greatly assisted in supporting Gaza in the Al-Aqsa flood battle. It is essential to recognize that Yemen's intervention has transformed the battle from a supportive one into a strategic one at the global level. Meanwhile, in South Lebanon, the 106-kilometer front along the border with the occupied Palestinian territories has undoubtedly become a major concern for both the United States of America and Zionist Israel. Additionally, it poses a challenge for Western countries, especially those with contingents within peacekeeping forces in South Lebanon. The operations have increased and their geographic origins have expanded. Besides Yemen and Lebanon, there have been almost daily attacks with regular missile strikes and drone attacks against U.S. occupation forces in Iraq and Syria. The pace of targeting U.S. occupation bases in Syria and Iraq is escalating. The resistance has altered its approach, intensifying the targeting both quantitatively and qualitatively. The number of targeting operations in a single day for a single base has increased significantly. For example, the Ain al-Assad base recorded 3 strikes within a few hours last Tuesday, December 12, highlighting a current trend where rocket barrages have become a characteristic of the ongoing escalation. This scene carries within it a decision by the resistance to transition to more impactful strikes against U.S. forces, potentially hastening their withdrawal from both Iraq and Syria.
Now to discuss this issue with us from Damascus is Ms. Vanessa Bailey, independent journalist and very dear friend. It's a pleasure having you on with us, Vanessa, today to discuss these escalatory confrontations between the axis of resistance and the American occupation and the Zionist occupation in West Asia. But for the first time since the integration of the resistance axis in West Asia, we see that it is waging such a real and broad battle within the framework of the Palestinian Al-Aqsa battle, beginning with Hezbollah in Lebanon, which shares 106 kilometer with Palestine, and with the Zionist entity basically in direct confrontation with the Zionist entity since October 8, 2023. How has Hezbollah's attack served the resistance in Gaza?
Well, Hezbollah's campaign and, of course, the tremendous sacrifices made by Hezbollah resistance fighters has been tremendously beneficial to the resistance, both in Gaza and in the West Bank, of course, where there is a much lower key, or in the sense of media coverage, but the same kind of ethnic cleansing operation continuing. Of course, what Hezbollah's operations have done, although they have been strategically very controlled and contained to try and prevent the escalation that, of course, the US and Israel and the UK and the EU cartel are looking for, It has effectively kept the Zionist forces in the north of the occupied territories busy with Hezbollah and unable, therefore, to send reinforcements to Gaza and to the West Bank to help with the ethnic cleansing programs that are ongoing in those areas of Palestinians. And equally, of course, what it has done has had a tremendous impact upon the settlements, the Zionist settlements in the northern territories, actually evacuating almost all of them and leaving them as ghost towns. Of course, this is another wound in the side of Israel, because the loss of settler communities from inside the occupied territories effectively means that there is no need for Israel to exist. Mm-hmm. And so therefore these two wounds, first of all, the keeping the Zionist forces occupied in this area along this border, but also, as I said, the evacuation of the settlements all along that border, mm-hmm. is a tremendous psychological effect upon the
Definitely.
Zionist regime and population.
Sorry. Moving on to another front for the Axis of Resistance, the escalation of resistance operation against the American occupation bases, especially U.S. bases in Iraq and Syria, indicate that the Axis of Resistance has actually begun to deal with the core conspirator against the Arab and Islamic nations and humanity as a whole, actually. Meaning the United States of America here. So far, the Pentagon has confirmed that at least 70 of its soldiers were injured as a result of repeated attacks on its bases in Syria and Iraq by the resistance. How will the U.S. be able to deal with this unprecedented escalation at so many levels?
Well, of course, what they're doing in Syria is to trigger their various proxies, which include ISIS and al-Qaeda and the Kurdish separatists in the northeast, to attack Syrian Arab army positions in central Syria and in northern Hama, northern Latakia, west of Aleppo. And those attacks since October the 7th have intensified in coordination with the Islamic resistance and the Palestinian resistance factions within Syria that are using Syrian territory to carry out attacks not only on the US bases, which are priority, but also against the Zionist-occupied Golan territories. And of course, what we have seen then also is the primary proxy of the U.S. Alliance in the Middle East, Israel, carrying out consistent and systematic air aggression against Syria, including yesterday when they targeted one of the air defense bases in the western countryside of Damascus. So the U.S. is waging, for the time being, a proxy war against the resistance factions in Iraq and in Syria.
Mm-hmm. Well, we also saw that after more than 70 days, it is no longer a secret that the United States of America is effectively leading the war on the Palestinian people in Gaza in such a genocidal way, and it is in their hands to stop this genocide or to continue with this genocide, and they're choosing to continue. It is no longer hidden that the United States of America's fear the expansion of the battle at a larger scale, threatening their overall strategies in the region, especially with the Yemen being such a vital heavy player in this, in the Red Sea and Bab el-Mandeb. What do you think is the United States' post-war strategy, and maybe the resistance one, if there is one exists, if there is a post-war day to begin with?
Yeah. Well, I think for the resistance axis, the nations that are currently taking part in the resistance and have not betrayed the Palestinian cause, there is a need to try, as I said, to control the escalation that the U.S. is looking for. I tend to see Israel now very much, and Netanyahu very much, as Zelensky and Ukraine. It's nothing more than a proxy war for the U.S., and Israel is the instrument that they're using to expand the war against Hezbollah, for example, and into Lebanon. We've seen many threats from Israel, which of course are indirectly coming from the United States, that if Hezbollah doesn't withdraw to the north of the Litani River, then Beirut will be turned into Khan Yunus. Are these empty threats? Are these desperate threats? From Israel, I would suggest yes, but from the U.S. that is looking and has been looking for escalation for some time, I believe they are looking for any justification or pretext to escalate both into Lebanon itself, into Syria, into Iraq, into Yemen. We've seen the potential of a coalition being formed of traitor Arab states with EU states, the UK and the US, to target Yemen, because Yemen, as you said, is having the greatest effect against the Zionist entity and against its controllers, let's say, rather than its allies. So I think the danger is that the US is looking for this escalation. It's looking to prevent the rise of BRICS, the rise of Iran in the region. And the only way that it sees that it can do that is by effectively destroying the resistance axis nations and taking control of more territory. So then we see the plan for greater Israel coming into play, of course. And again, as I said, the US is very much using the current extremist Zionist regime and its forces as an instrument to achieve as much of this as it can, just as it did with Zelensky in Ukraine against Russia.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems every day it's looking more and more like it is the day before the day of judgment. Everything seems like it's going to explode. I want to thank you very much, Vanessa Bealey, independent journalist from Damascus, talking to us about the recent coordinated escalations of the axis of resistance against U.S. occupation and Zionist Israel in support of the Palestinian resistance, obviously. Thank you very much for being with us. Thanks a million for your contribution to our show. Ladies and gents, thank you very much. I'll see you again next week. Assalamu alaikum.
A diverse range of programs. Youth, spirituality, culture, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, says more than 80% of Gaza's 2.4 million people have been driven from their homes, and many now live in cramped shelters or makeshift tents in the far south of the Gaza Strip. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Qatar's Al Jazeera television network has covered this story and tells us more. The Palestinian Islamic Jihad organization has strongly condemned the Israeli regime's plan to forcefully displace Palestinians from the Gaza Strip to other countries, saying it proves that the regime is committing genocide in this coastal territory. In a statement issued recently, the movement denounced the remarks made by officials of the Israeli regime regarding the displacement of the Palestinian people from the Gaza Strip and the search for countries to deport them to. The Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement added, "Such statements are ongoing war crimes that confirm the Zionist aggression on the Gaza Strip is a war of genocide against the existence of the Palestinian people in their homeland." The Israeli regime launched its deadly war on Gaza on 7th of October, following an operation by Gaza's resistance movement dubbed Operation Al-Aqsa Storm. More than 22,000 Palestinians, many of them women and children, have been massacred in the Israeli regime's military onslaught on Gaza. Throughout the war, the Israeli regime officials have been floating a plan which requires forced displacement of Palestinians living in the Gaza Strip and displacing them to other countries. Recently, the Israeli Finance Minister, Bezalel Smotrich, called for displacement of 2 million Palestinians from the besieged territory so that only around 200,000 Palestinians would remain in the Strip. His remarks were echoed recently by another extremist Israeli minister who called for the return of Israeli settlers to Gaza, claiming that Palestinians should be encouraged to emigrate from the territory. Itamar Ben-Gvir said, "We must promote a solution to encourage the emigration of Gaza's residents," adding that the onslaught on Gaza was an opportunity to develop a project to encourage Gaza's residents to emigrate to other countries. Commenting on their remarks, the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement said silence in the face of Israeli plans to displace the people of Gaza implies implicit encouragement for the Israeli regime to continue with its criminal activities. The movement warned that such agenda will not be limited to Gaza alone, adding that the plan threatens Arab national security and poses a definite danger to the stability of all countries in the West Asia region. Concluding the statement, the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement held the United States responsible for emboldening the Israeli regime to implement such a plan against the Palestinian people. The Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement said the United States is giving the Israeli regime the time and the weapons necessary to destroy all aspects of life in Gaza so that displacement becomes the only option for the Palestinians. As Israel's most dedicated and age-old ally, the United States of America has torpedoed the prospect of cessation of Israeli onslaught in Gaza, effectively vetoing all United Nations Security Council resolutions that have been calling for a permanent ceasefire in Gaza. Washington has also supplied the Israeli regime with more than 10,000 tons of advanced weaponry since the onslaught of the aggression in Gaza. However, the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement has vowed that Palestinian resistance groups will not hesitate to stand up to the United States-backed Israeli regime. The movement said, "We affirm that we will continue to confront this war of extermination and displacement, and we rely on the awareness of our people and the bravery of our fighters in the field to thwart these criminal activities." The Middle East Eye has also covered the same story and tells us more. According to Israel's Channel 12 News, former British Prime Minister Tony Blair is reportedly being tapped as the head of an Israeli initiative seeking to encourage other countries to take in Palestinians fleeing from Israel's vicious bombardment of Gaza. Channel 12 of Israeli television, without citing a source, has reported that Tony Blair recently met with Israeli regime Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and War Minister Benny Gantz to go over the possibility of the former British leader taking charge of where Palestinian refugees from Gaza could be relocated. Journalist Barak Ravid, in a post on X, said Tony Blair's office had denied the reports. Barak Ravid quoted a Blair spokesperson as saying, "Reports that Tony Blair has anything to do with the evacuation of Gazans is simply not true. There has been no such discussion, nor would he consider it." The Israeli regime has not made official comments regarding post-war refugee efforts. Most of the Palestinian population in Gaza, 1.8 million people, have been displaced since Israel began its devastating bombardment of the territory 3 months ago. On Saturday, the Wall Street Journal reported that 70% of Gaza's homes and half of the enclave's buildings have been damaged or destroyed in Israeli airstrikes. Civilians and health officials in Gaza have repeatedly stated that they believe the number of those massacred in Gaza is far higher than what is being published by the Ministry of Health due to people being trapped underneath the rubble and a lack of access to healthcare facilities and hospitals throughout the territory. For his part, The Israeli regime Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu recently said he planned to continue the deadly offensive in Gaza for many more months. Netanyahu said in a televised speech, "The war is at its height. We are fighting on all fronts. Achieving victory will require time." As the Israeli Army Chief of Staff has said, the war will continue. Netanyahu also said that Israel would take over Gaza's border with Egypt and close any access points to the territory. Meanwhile, the extreme far-right Israeli Finance Minister, Bezalel Smotrich, told Israel's Army Radio recently that there will be an exodus of Palestinians and instead Israelis will live in the Gaza Strip. Smotrich added, "We will not allow a situation in which 2 million people live there. If there are 100,000 to 200,000 Arabs living in Gaza, the discussion about the day after will be completely different." Smotrich added, "And for completely changing the reality in Gaza, having a conversation about settlements in the Gaza Strip will need to rule there for a long time. If we want to be there militarily, we need to be there in a civilian fashion as well."
Face to face. Hello, everyone, and welcome to a new edition of Face to Face. Today, we're having the Minister of Foreign Affairs in the Yemeni government, Mr. Hisham Sharaf. Welcome, Mr. Hisham, and thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
The events of the October 7th, which took the Israeli regime and its Western sponsors by complete surprise, marked a watershed moment in the Palestinian struggle for the liberation of occupied territories. How did Martyr Qasem Soleimani contribute to it?
If everyone follows up on the sequence of events in the occupied territories, you'll find that Martyr Soleimani was the one who used to go around to different places supporting all those forces in the axis of resistance. So when it comes to the occupied territories, Martyr Soleimani, I think, was the main supporter of these forces in Palestine, either by training or by supplying with weapons and all kinds of supports. You can say that after so many years of support, the Palestinians were ready to take such kind of event, which marked the peak of their achievements in Palestine.
Palestinian resistance leaders, including Hamas chief Ismail Haniyeh, have described Martyr Soleimani as the martyr of Quds. Are we close to the moment when his dream of the liberation of Al-Quds will be realized?
Yes, I think we are close. If not for that big support in terms of moral support, in terms of financial support, in terms of also the weapons supplied to the resistance in Palestine, we could not achieve such kind of a step onward. So I think we are close to such event, and God helps us in doing so.
What role did Martyr Soleimani play in Yemen, especially in helping the people here and the resistance of the Arab country overcome the foreign occupation and aggression?
I go back to the same question on the beginning of this interview. Martyr Soleimani also was looking very carefully to Yemen, and he did a lot for Yemen to be ready to, let's say, retaliate against the forces who led the aggression on our country. I think the Red Sea witnessed such kind of support that Martyr Soleimani gave to Yemen, and you will see what will happen soon in that area and also what happened in terms of controlling the Red Sea.
This week marked the second anniversary of the passing of Hassan Irlo, Iran's former ambassador in Yemen, a close aide and confidant of Martin Soleimani. Tell us something about him and his contribution to your struggle against the Saudi Emirati American Israeli axis.
When the aggression happened on Yemen, everyone went away, except the Islamic Republic of Iran, which actually was the only supporter of Yemeni people and Yemeni forces fighting against the aggression. The presence of the ambassador of Iran in Yemen, I mean, Hassan Irlo, presented a big support to us. He used to go everywhere in Yemen. He used to go to our celebrations. He used to go to our meetings. He used to meet us here at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs a lot. So his presence actually gave us this moral support, and he gave us this feeling that we are not alone in our defense against the excess of aggression. And I think if not for Hassan Irlo, you will not see the news coming from Sana'a to different countries in the world. Iran used to help us in getting our news all over the world through the media Iran has. We don't have such media, but they do, and they helped us a lot in letting the whole world know we are defending our country.
Mr. Hisham, how would you define the life and legacy of Mr. Soleimani and his contribution to the axis of resistance from Palestine to Syria to Lebanon to Yemen and elsewhere?
From the literature I used to read, and also from the different stories we used to receive through the media, Martyr Qasem Soleimani was very active, not sitting in one place and trying to watch what is happening at the excess of resistance. No. He used to travel all over these countries, either officially, I mean, known that he is here or there, or unofficially. And I think his presence in these countries gave the resistance the real feeling that we are not alone in the axis of resistance. We had someone who represented a symbol of our fight against these aggression forces, and I can say that he was the main drive of our resistance against these countries when they attacked us.
Iran has been an all-weather ally and supporter of Yemen. What is the status of relation between the two countries, and how much do you value ties with Iran, Mr. Hisham?
First of all, I would like to say that Iran was not supporting Yemen only during this period of aggression against our country. Iran had a good cooperation history with us. And when the aggression war happened against our country, Iran was the only country that came in front of the whole world and said that I am with Yemen, I am with the Yemeni people. And also, they used to give support in terms of medications, in terms of other type of supports at the universities, health sector, and other places. If not for the Iranian support for Yemen, officially in front of the whole world, no one will hear the stories coming from Yemen. So we do appreciate what has been given to our country. And we hope also this cooperation will continue when this aggression is over. We would give Iran the first place in the form of rebuilding our country through different sectors that Yemen needs, and mainly reconstructing the country which was ruined by the aggression.
Turning to Gaza and the events now, at a time when many Arab countries have chosen to be mute spectators to the genocide unfolding there, Yemen has shown what true solidarity means. Why is Palestine so important for Yemen, for you?
I can say that it's so important to us because we put Palestine as the central and core issue that we are fighting for. Yes. Of course, we as Yemenis are fighting for our country. But again, looking to this long-term history of aggression, of the abuse of our brothers in Palestine, who would stand by them? We used, when we were kids, to hear a lot about Arab countries with Palestine, with Palestinian people, but no one really showed a real move towards fighting for them. I think we found in this issue, the issue of our brothers in Palestine, the real issue that we can fight for. If we don't stand by them at this critical moment, doing something the world will listen to, no one would. So we have stood beside them, either by getting all these kind of demonstrations or putting all our media serving their case, or at the same time putting our capabilities in terms of the military, in terms of other sectors, no one will do. So we have taken that very dare step towards supporting our brothers in Palestine.
So you feel like it's your responsibility as Muslims to liberate the occupied territories?
Not liberate. I mean, let's say we will contribute
to the liberation.
To the liberation of Palestine. And we give some kind of an example to our brothers in other countries. They can do the same. We have done it, and we are poor. We don't have too much capability in terms of moving to Palestine, but looking to Yemen as Yemen and looking to other countries who have more than us, we give them an example of what they can do in the near future.
Do you believe that there will be other countries, I mean Arab countries, will join you in what you're doing to the Palestinian people?
Yes, I do believe so in the people of those countries. Sometimes maybe when you speak about the ruling, let's say, groups or the ruling families or the governments that govern these countries, you can't tell what will happen because of their interests. But in terms of the people of the Arab countries, I am sure they will move one day or another.
There have been a string of attacks on Israeli-linked vessels in the Red Sea in recent weeks, which has rattled the Zionist entity and its Western backers. Yemeni officials say these attacks will continue until food and medicine are made available to people in Gaza. Is it just about food and medicine, or also about the end of the military occupation in Palestine?
I can't say that it's really a show of solidarity at the beginning. Mm-hmm. When you want to show the world that there is someone who keeps standing beside the Palestinian people in their miseries, Yemen is the one. So it's a show of solidarity, number one. Number two, also it's a beginning of different steps towards the liberation that you mentioned. Yemen, with its limited resources, did something that we think it's our duty. Mm-hmm. So what we are doing now gives an example to other countries that they can do the same.
Mm-hmm. The much-hyped alliance announced by the United States to bully the Yemeni military has failed to take off so far. We heard the Yemeni defense minister saying that the Red Sea would be turned into a graveyard for the U.S.-led alliance if the Yemeni territorial integrity is violated. What should we expect?
First of all, I can't say that this is our sea. The Red Sea is, and the also the Arabian Sea, it's our sea. So those who came to that area, they don't know what the hell is going there. They're talking about the freedom of marine transport. They are talking about the respect of the international law. We know what the international says. We defend our territories. And when we have declared that position against Israeli flagged ships or ships discharging at Israeli ports, it's our duty to ask the whole world to look to what's going on. We want the siege to be over. We want also all kind of necessities to go to the occupied land. And at the same time, we would like them to know that we can contribute to stopping their movement at that sea, attacking our brothers. So probably it will be the first step towards building an alliance to start the liberation of Palestine.
Americans have accused the Islamic Republic of Iran of being deeply involved in the attacks carried out by the Yemeni military against Israeli-linked vessels in the Red Sea. How would you respond to that? Is really Iran involved in these attacks?
The Americans always accuse Iran of many things, not only about Yemen. Anything that happens in the Gulf or in the Red Sea or somewhere else in areas close to Iran, they say Iran is behind it. This step was taken by, this step of closing Bab al-Mandab and at the same time threatening all flagged or Israeli flagged ships not to pass through our area has been taken according to the instructions of our leadership, according to our belief that Palestine is our central issue. When we speak about Palestine, we speak about an issue that goes deeply into our doctrine or into our belief that this land should be liberated. So again, we declare to the whole world, it was taken by our people, by our army, by our own decision, and any support that might be given to us by Iran or other countries besides Iran, we welcome it. But we are the ones, the Yemeni government in Sana'a is the one who has taken that decision, and that decision was based on real reasons not to allow the Israeli aggression to continue on our brothers in Palestine, in Gaza, in different areas of the occupied land.
We've been reading news that recently the vessels in the Red Sea have been identifying themselves as "we are not linked to Israel" for the first time in history. Do you believe that this might be an indicator that Yemen will be a powerful force in the region and maybe in the world?
Why not? We will do our best to be really a power in the region. And if you read about Yemen for a long time used to be one of the strong countries. Except for the latest events in terms of the economy, in terms of some problems politically happened in Yemen. Yemen has the potential to be a very strong country. We have the people, we have the will to do so. And I think this is the first step to realize our capabilities in the region. With the help of the access of resistance, I think we can be a real force that could change the equation in the region. We are a peaceful force. We are not really a threat to anyone. We are trying our best to help our brothers in Palestine and also at the same time to keep the sovereignty of our sea, the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden. Again, we tell the whole world, we are a peaceful country. We are not trying to show some kind of a threat to our brothers in the region. But at the same time, when the time comes for fighting, we are ready for such fighting.
How do you respond to the sayings that you are a threat to the international maritime?
I think it's a big lie that is being spread all over the media, all over the world. We have not attacked any ship that is not going to the Zionist state at all. We have not threatened any ship or any vessel that is going to discharge its goods to the Zionist ports. We only trying to tell the world we are against such kind of genocide that is done against our brothers in Palestine, and we have the right to do so. Now, all marine activity is allowed in that Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden. Everyone in the world knows that, but again, it's this kind of stopping or derouting the ships from our area is some kind of a consequence of all the lies, of all the media rumors that the Yemenis in that part of the world are attacking all ships getting through that route. Again, through this interview, we tell the whole world, any ship that is not going to the Zionist state, any ship that is not flagging Israel flag on its ships or owned by some people from the Zionist state it can go well, and they have to respond to us when we signal them. One of the problems of some of the ships, they try to be smart. They don't respond to the signals sent by our marine forces. So our people, when they give the signal first, twice, third time, then they shoot. They give warning shots only. They don't destroy any ship. So again, I can tell the whole world, we are not against the marine activity in that region. That region in the Red Sea is safe. But everyone should know that as long as our brothers in Gaza are suffering, we are not going to stay silent. We will do something to let the world know about that genocide happening in Gaza.
Mr. Hisham, 3 years since General Soleimani's martyrdom, do you think the U.S. hegemony in the region has come to an end and a new world order is taking shape in which the axis of resistance holds an important part in the world?
That day is coming. But again, these countries of the axis of resistance should move faster than they are doing it now. I have this only remark about what there is done. You look to these countries sometimes as separate blocks. Everyone is working on its side or on its area. They have to come to a point when all the forces come together, and as much as the Western forces are forming this kind of naval cooperation, they have formed this kind of aerial cooperation, forming alliances, and they send ships to the sea, the axis, the countries of the axis of resistance should start thinking from now, forming such kind of alliances, showing them to the world, and there is no law that says you cannot form such kind of alliances, and sending all your ships, all your forces in different areas. They should start from now on. Otherwise, they will be only doing all these kind of actions from their different countries.
My last question for you, sir, is what is your message to the foreign ministers of the other Arab countries?
I can really, I take this opportunity first at the end of the year 2023 and coming to a new year to tell all of our Arab countries' foreign ministers that if not coming together and forming alliance also between Arab countries to defend themselves against the attack of others in the region or outside the region, one day will come when Arab countries will be eaten one by one. Getting all together, regardless of some of the very narrow goals of some of them, they have to come all together defending the Arab countries' unity and also coming back to the same old principles of Arab countries working together for the Arab countries' population, not for the Arab countries' rulers or those who rule these countries. Rulers go.
Yes.
And people stay. So again, this should be taken into consideration in the coming years.
Thank you so much, sir, for your time and giving us the opportunity to be with you today.
Thank you for your network to come for this meeting today.
Thank you so much.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. The Limelight.
In the United States, Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson said on Sunday, 31st of December, that Texas Governor Greg Abbott was sowing seeds of chaos by sending buses of migrants to Chicago without prior warning. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The national broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. Two Democratic mayors said there's a lack of coordination over the transportation of migrants to their cities and others by the Texas Governor Greg Abbott, which has led to disorder in managing the arrivals. Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson said in an interview with Face the Nation on Sunday, 31st of December, Greg Abbott, a Republican, is determined to continue to sow seeds of chaos by sending busloads of migrants to the city of Chicago without any coordination. Now he's taken on this very dangerous task of placing individuals on airplanes and flying them into our various cities. This is certainly a matter of not just of our national security, but it's the type of chaos that this governor is committed to administering, Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson said. Johnson added, that type of chaos it's certainly divided in our country, and we need better coordination between all levels of government to be able to respond to this mission. The mayor of Denver, Colorado, Mike Johnson, told Face the Nation that his city does not want migrants to arrive in the middle of the night when staff is not available to receive them and migrants are left outside in the freezing cold weather with no support. We want buses here to do what every other bus does, which is land at a bus station and a bus stop at hours where we can have staff there to receive them and to direct them towards services, Denver Mayor Mike Johnson said. Mike Johnson added, we understand the flow is coming, we just want it to be coordinated and in a humanitarian way, which we think makes it effective for the city and for those newcomers. So that means things like arriving 8 to 5, Monday to Friday, with prior notice. Both mayors called for more federal support as the influx stresses city resources. Johnson & Johnson joined the mayors of New York, Los Angeles, and Houston in November in writing a letter to the White House to ask for more financial support, increased work authorization for migrants, and prioritize a coordinated entry response to ensure new arrivals make it to their final destination. What we have is clearly an international and federal crisis that local governments are being asked to subsidize, and this is unsustainable. None of our local economies are positioned to be able to carry on such a mission, the mayor of Chicago emphasized. The mayor of Denver, Colorado, said migrants from Venezuela who arrived in recent months are not eligible for temporary protected status and do not have a quick pass to be authorized to work in the United States. He said the migrants want to work and there are employers with open jobs who want to hire them. But we have folks that right now are currently without a pass to work authorization. We'd love to see that pass to work authorization expand for more recent arrivals, Mayor Johnson said. As state and local leaders ask for federal help in managing the record number of migrants, Congress has been debating border policy changes for weeks as part of a larger package including aid for Ukraine, but has so far been unable to reach a consensus. Democrats are considering drastic limits on asylum and increased deportations in exchange for Republicans supporting more aid for Ukraine. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina said Texas Governor Greg Abbott is a desperate man trying to protect his state. Our system is broken, Senator Graham told Face the Nation on Sunday. You're going to have mayors talking about more money to help relocate migrants. We're not going to have a remain in Texas policy. Senator Lindsey Graham said Republicans want the Biden administration to implement a Title 42-like policy, the policy allowed the United States to quickly expel unauthorized migrants at the southern border with Mexico during the coronavirus pandemic. "Here's what I would tell the Biden administration," Senator Graham said. "Accept the idea that we're full. Take the tools we're willing to give you to stop the inflow. Start deporting people here who should be deported. Accept the tools that would change things and will get money for Ukraine."